Hello, I'm Rachel Babin from the Oncology Network. Welcome to the second part of the OJT's 2023 review episode. With a Trans-Tasman lens, our host team includes Craig Underhill, Kate Clark, and Chris Jackson. If you've not already listened to part one, I suggest you stop here and head back there before returning to this, the second part. We hope you enjoy the return of the OJC. This is Rachel Babin, and this is the Oncology Journal Club podcast.
I just wanted to refer everybody to an interesting paper in Nature Medicine, which is one of our favourite show-off papers that we read on the podcast. But it was an article entitled 11 Clinical Trials That Will Shape Medicine in 2024. And one that was referred to was the NADINA study, which is an international study of using immunotherapy as a neoadjuvant treatment versus standard adjuvant nivolumab for patients with stage 3 melanoma. But one of the 11 papers, the second one in oncology, was Destiny 12. I'm not sure, Kate, which number the Destiny series the paper was that we just presented. It's not in the title on the New England Journal.
It's Destiny 4.
So this one study, they refer to Destiny 12, which is sort of proving the CNS activity of these drugs. So it's interesting. They seem to get into the CNS and treat brain metastases as well, which I guess is a plus for these compounds. And they're not going to be just for breast cancer, probably. They're going to be utilized in other cancers as well.
Bouncing off your reference to the NADINA study, Craig, of neoadjuvant nivolumab. Of course, this year they published one study of neoadjuvant Pembro versus adjuvant Pembro in stage 3 melanoma, resectable stage 3 melanoma. And that to me was, this study was one of the real highlights of 2023 as well. It was a study which showed that if you gave 3 cycles of neoadjuvant Pembro followed by the remaining 14 after the operation in resectable patients, you know, bulky nodal disease mostly, compared to upfront surgery followed by adjuvant, you had a longer event-free survival at 2 years. So the event-free survival in the experimental arm was 72% versus 49% in the standard arm. So that increase of 23% to EFS just by a change of the schedule of administration of the Pembro was pretty impressive. And that's, of course, on top of a plus 10% DFS you get with using Pembro versus nothing in that situation. So that's potentially a 20 to 30% gain overall by the addition of IO in the perioperative period over surgery alone. So that's a real advance in melanoma. That was 3 cycles of Pembro, just 3 cycles, so 9 weeks. You do get those early progressors, and so there was a question of how you interpreted those early progressors. But actually, in clinical practice, if you resect and then go for adjuvant, you actually have quite a large number of people who progress quite quickly after an operation anyway. So some of that, you know, progression on neoadjuvant may just be those early progressors anyway who are primary refractory. So, of course, Australia has pivoted to the use of neoadjuvants. I think you're the only country in the world, aren't you, which has got the access there. Your PBS made that available after the submissions of Prof. Georgina Long and co. And I think that's a great model for the rest of us to watch. People are still saying that you need a confirmatory trial on that. And of course, we don't have OS from the adjuvant studies yet, which we do need to see for Pembro. But I think that is a really major and clinically meaningful gain.
Fantastic. Got another short bite for us, Chris?
Yeah, I think the Rapido update. So this was the update of short course radiation followed by 6 cycles of capecitabine and oxaliplatin in rectal cancers. This is high-risk rectal cancer, T4, and heavily node positive. And what the longer follow-up showed, the initial study showed, was that we had an improvement in distant metastasis-free survival, so it was a real gain. And the resource consumption by using short course is clearly favourable. And competitor study in this area is Prodige 23, which is FOLFIRINOX, followed by long-course chemo-RT. FOLFIRINOX, of course, more toxic than capecitabine and oxaliplatin. Long-course more resource intensive than Rapido. So Rapido is an attractive option. But unfortunately, the local recurrence rate was quite a lot higher. So it was 12% with the short course followed by Capox compared to 8% in the standard arm. And so the thought is that the short course isn't really eradicating a resistant clone in some patients. You're getting a high rate of local recurrence. And that has made a lot of people pivot away from Rapido, unfortunately. And probably more people are now using Pradige 23 as their standard regime in those patients eligible for TNT rather than that cheaper and more less resource-intensive Rapido regime. Kate, what would you say the practice is in your networks around TNT?
Can we just explain to our listeners what's TNT? So you guys are GI oncologists, so am I, but some of the listeners won't know what that is. So total neoadjuvant therapy, right? So it's given for rectal cancer, giving everything, giving your chemo and your radiotherapy up front. Is that correct?
Yeah, look, I think it's a misnomer because we actually also have patients who have TNT, total neoadjuvant therapy, and then never actually have surgery. So I think the language is poor, and I think the arguments are ongoing. Our practice is quite varied in Wellington, as in we try to be very clever, and I think maybe we're being too clever. So we have patients having not straight to surgery. We have patients on short course, then surgery. We have patients on long course chemo-rad, then surgery. Our TNT preferred regimen probably is Pradige, and that's more about resourcing and hiring because that gives the surgeons and the radiation oncologists, who are our resource problems, time to get their ducks in a row while we get people started on chemo, which in our unit is relatively easy to access. I think it's these conversations are so complex now.
They truly are. So just explain Pradige, Kate, for the people who are not used to doing that.
Yeah, so Pradige being the pancreatic regimen, the FOLFIRINOX, for 3 months, followed by long course chemo-rad with capecitabine. So what is it, 50-something gray in 5 weeks, then a six-week break, then an operation, and the paper included a further 3 months of FOLFIRINOX. I put that way because I think a lot of people in practice probably not prescribing that second 3 months, and it's also therefore not total neoadjuvant therapy. But it was published before IDEA. We don't have data whether or not that was sensible. Yeah, I think these conversations are really interesting, and I think when people relapse in the future, somebody looking backwards and thinking, was the right thing done? I think it's going to be impossible to tell. Yeah.
Yeah, it is complicated. It just shows why these cases need to be presented into an MDT. So, Chris, is that Pradige type regimen for FOLFIRINOX long course chemo RT what you do routinely for the bulky rectal cancers now?
Yeah, well, I think there's another study as well for slightly earlier rectal cancer presented at ASCO, which was the PROSPECT study, which was neoadjuvant chemotherapy with selective radiotherapy in localized rectal cancer. And this was presented in, it was either the GI oral or the plenary, I think it was the plenary at ASCO this year. And it was an excellent pragmatic study, but for slightly lower risk tumors, which showed that you could omit radiation therapy in some people. What I really liked about the PROSPECT study as well was that not only was radiotherapy able to be omitted in some patients, but when they published the study, they simultaneously published the quality of life data at exactly the same time. And I think that that PROSPECT study was not only a nice study which showed radiation could be omitted in a low to intermediate risk group of rectal cancer patients, but that the quality of life data was presented simultaneously, which is useful for directing therapy. And in rectal cancer, functional outcomes are just so important. So continence, sexual function are critical outcomes, and we just too often don't have that level of data available to inform our discussions. And in particular, the watch and wait protocols where you give long course chemo RT or high dose chemotherapy followed by chemo RT. What are the functional outcomes of that compared to a shorter, less intensive therapy with surgery earlier? And what are the long-term functional outcomes there? So we may be over-treating a group of patients and causing harm with these more intensive regimes. And so what are the trade-offs? We need to know that. You can only do that through those outcomes. And I think that is, again, the PROSPECT study would be a type of study which common sense oncology would say, great study, you know, patient outcomes that matter. You've got less resource intensive therapy, de-escalation of therapy, and quality of life data that you can have that conversation around. In terms of what we're doing locally with treatment, I think finally we've got some really good randomized data in rectal cancer, which we were missing for so long. We had the pre-TME era of data, and then now we've got a post-TME era data with randomized studies. I think there's a number of standards, and so often in oncology, it's the art of what is achievable in your network in terms of where your resource constraints lie. And now I think there are a number of options to discuss with patients, with patient priorities, patient outcomes in terms of organ preservation, patient priorities in terms of treatment intensity and availability for treatment, because long course chemo RT and 3 months worth of Pradige type chemotherapy, FOLFIRINOX chemotherapy, is time intensive, and people who are trying to pay the bills through their job might not be able to take that amount of time off work to undergo such an extensive treatment.
Fantastic.
Yeah, look, I think we have to have patients sitting around the table when we're designing these trials. So yeah, I've got to wind that up, Craig, but I just want to put my little, because it segues quite nicely into my little bites. Can I do that? Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. So, patients being included in the design of studies, that's radical.
Yeah. So my couple of bites from San Antonio, you know, I think I didn't get to go this year, so I'm a bit miffed, but San Antonio, Texas, big breast cancer conference, you know, conference about women in a place that loves women, was two articles about breast cancer survivors and pregnancy. So some looked at BRCA, BRCA positive patients who'd had breast cancer, subsequently had a pregnancy with a, you know, baby, and there's no difference in recurrence rates. So that's a really useful bit of information for women who are often counseled not to get pregnant. So we now know that's safe. I think the other thing that was in women who'd had previously had breast cancer, the positive trial, that IVF and other fertility treatments do not change people's recurrence risk. So again, really useful information for individual women. And that fits really nicely with the PROSPECT trial, because irradiating a woman's pelvis takes any choice away forever. And with the rectal cancer pandemic that we're having in young people, it's really, mm-hmm. really important to be able to have that option.
Yeah. And there was a paper this year about that, about the, you know, the change in the lowering the age risk in GI cancers, in particular colon cancer. So we might put a link to that paper as well. So that's useful information for people to know.
I did have one little more short bite, but only just because it frustrates me, and the purists are going to jump all over me. So Sonia was published or presented at ESMO this year. So metastatic breast cancer, first line. Women were pragmatically randomized in the whole of a European country. Women with metastatic breast cancer were given either an aromatase inhibitor alone, and then at progression was switched to an alternative hormonal agent and a CDK4/6 inhibitor, such as Palbo. I think you guys have Ribo and Abemaciclib as well. Or they were given that CDK4/6 inhibitor up front. There is absolutely no difference at when that second progression-free survival happens, and therefore absolutely no difference at overall survival. And yet we are still having trials where there was no access to CDK4/6 in the control arm being touted as exciting news. The advantage of Sonia meant it halved the length of time women were on a very expensive therapy with fantastic outcomes. So that's my little soapbox. So at San Antonio, again, there was more CDK4/6 with OS when they cheated in the control arm. So
thanks, you, Kate. It's great to have a little bit of breast cancer results presented on the podcast. I've just got a couple of things to highlight. I think we have to mention probably one of the highlights at ESMO, and one of the hyped presentations was the combination of enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab in previously untreated advanced urothelial cancer. So another conjugated antibody. And so this study presented at ESMO was based on a phase 2, which was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, showing quite impressive results and durable responses and very good median overall survival in a phase 2 with patients receiving a combination of the enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab who were ineligible for receiving cisplatin. So about half the patients who have advanced urothelial cancer can't have cisplatin because of poor renal function or are too unwell. And so this was given in those cisplatin ineligible patients. We've got a link to those results. But what happened at ESMO is the presentation of the randomized phase 3 study of this combination in enfortumab vedotin in combination with pembrolizumab versus standard of care chemotherapy in previously untreated patients with advanced metastatic urothelial carcinoma. It was a big study of almost 900 patients. The endpoints were a blinded, centralized response, PFS, and overall survival. And so the toxicities, the grade 3-4 toxicities are actually slightly lower with this combination than was seen with the chemotherapy, but some big differences in the main endpoints of event-free survival and overall survival. So we're talking about a 50% reduction in the risk of progression or death in the patients who received the non-chemotherapy containing. So there was a lot of hype at ESMO after this was presented in one of the plenaries. It was one of the late-breaking abstracts. Of course, this is a really expensive treatment. So it's two novel agents up front. There's probably, you know, no health system in the world that's going to be able to afford this at current prices. But you would think that the cost of pembrolizumab, now listed on the list of essential cancer drugs by the WHO, you'd think that the price of that's going to be coming down. So a lot of hype some people gave a standing ovation to the presenter in the plenary. I always struggle with that concept a little bit. It's not like everybody was cured. It's not like 100% of patients who received this drug were cured. I always reflect on all the patients I've treated with the previous regimens that don't do so well, the fact that they've passed away, the fact that half the patients on this trial didn't receive the investigational agent. I actually think, you know, it's a bit over the top to be giving a standing ovation, but that's just my personal view. You know, this is a leap forward, but there's still a way to go, really, to bring this into practice. And we can still improve on that because it's not curing everybody with advanced disease. And then the last little super quick one was a study published in the JCO, randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study of olanzapine for chemotherapy-related anorexia, patients with locally advanced gastric, pancreas, hepatobiliary, or lung cancer. So this is a really common problem, isn't it? A loss of appetite, cachexia, and anorexia. And so it fits probably with the common sense theme, Chris. This is a pretty simple, inexpensive drug, low dose, and it was shown to have a significant improvement in quality of life, nutritional status, and less chemotoxicity because it probably addressed the nausea related to chemo. So that's an interesting one, and that's applicable, you know, right across a number of cancers. And so most of the listeners are probably, or a lot of the listeners will be subscribing to Up to Date. They've actually got a page of the main advances in oncology for 2023, listed by tumor and then listed by supportive care as well. So that's just interesting. A lot of them are phase two or really new treatments, not yet standard of care. But if you want to go to one place and get an idea of the names of all these new drugs and where things are going in individual cancers, I think it's worth having a quick look if you're a subscriber to Up to Date. Chris, what do you reckon?
Look, I found that olanzapine study was fantastic, actually, and that's been one of the things which I would say has changed in my practice this year, has been the widespread use of that. I think, as you say, the issues with nausea and loss of appetite are really important to patients. And I think having low-grade ongoing nausea constantly, as happens in a lot of people with gastric cancer or pancreatic cancer, is a really limiting issue. And olanzapine is cheap. It's about 10 cents a tablet or something like that. So you're talking about an additional therapy, which is costing not very much. The out-of-pocket costs in New Zealand, either free or $5 per month for that. And to improve their appetite and quality of life is huge.
Oh my God, even the Kiwis can afford it. It must be cheap as chips, Chris.
Yeah, we can certainly afford drugs that were patented in 1960, I think it was. But it's a great drug, and I found it's really helpful for patients.
Yeah, there was a great presentation at AGRTG just to emphasize what you said, that so we sort of look at the grade 3 and 4 toxicities often, but those persistent low grade toxicities, grade 1 and 2, but goes on and on and on while they're on treatment, actually has quite a huge impact on people's experience and quality of life. So I haven't really got into the olanzapine. So when I was researching for this, you know, best of 2023, came across it. So I think I'm going to start using it a bit more. There's a salient reminder of the benefits of this drug. So it's great. Kate, do you use it much?
So we started using it when we reviewed our antiemetic policy. When ASCO presented new guidelines, I feel like it was in the middle of 2020, we reduced significantly the amount of ondansetron and started using olanzapine more, and pretty much actually gave metoclopramide away for a lot of our patients. So then once you get comfortable with olanzapine, I have to get, you know, the 5 milligram dose I think is too much. But 2.5 milligrams BD for most of my patients is really quite helpful, either on chemo or off. And it has the advantages for many of them. If they do take 5 milligrams at night, they get a reasonable night's sleep as well. So the tricky part in changing anything new like that, of course, is that all of the, so when our patients in New Zealand go to the chemist, they get a information sheet from the pharmacist, separate from any communication that I've had. And it often has on it that it's an antipsychotic. So I've had some very interesting conversations with patients. Yeah. You know, it's 1/100th of the dose that you require to be an antipsychotic. It's not going to cause you any problems. But that took a long time, and took a long time with the pharmacists as well. Why is this patient having this medicine? What are you up to? You know, but incredibly useful drug, really cheap.
I often get in the front foot and I sort of explain to them this is an old-fashioned antipsychotic, but it's used at a much lower dose. And in this study, it was only half a tablet, 2.5 milligrams daily. So anyway, there you go. For those who are not prescribing olanzapine for the patients, and this was not nausea and vomiting, this was for anorexia and loss of appetite. So, you know, it's probably worth considering Wow, we've covered a lot. There's a lot happening.
So the other thing that all patients with upper GI malignancies need to have a think about is exocrine insufficiency, and I think that will be for another podcast, but it's a really simple, cheap intervention. Yeah. And we don't do it enough. So it's not always the 5-FU or the C. diff causing the diarrhea. So do your fecal elastase and prescribe that PERT, please.
Professor Jackson, anything you wanted to say?
I think when olanzapine was first introduced into the chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting guidelines, their recommended dose was 10 milligrams in the original study, and then they had a smaller study which showed 5 was equivalent to 10. And certainly we found 10 caused quite a lot of somnolence, and so 5 we're pretty comfortable with now, I think. And having 2.5 once a day for the appetite stimulation is really good. I get a lot of people asking about medicinal cannabis or cannabis oils, for example, and in the New Zealand context, they're about $300 a month, and one of the main benefits of that is actually appetite. And if you've got a drug which is, you know, essentially free versus something which is $300 a month and it does have that benefit of appetite, it's a good substitute.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Chris. On that note, I think we might leave it there. I just want to say thank you to Rachel, our producer, for setting this up. Thanks both to Kate and Chris for agreeing to come on this podcast. Been fantastic to have a chat and looking at the highlights of 2023. It's over and out. And Merry Christmas to both of you. Happy holidays, whatever you're celebrating. Is there a Maori equivalent? Happy Christmas. They traditionally, of course, weren't Christians, but now often heavily Christian faithful. Is there a Maori expression for Merry Christmas?
Meri kerehimiti.
Fantastic. And Happy New Year as well.
Yep. Ma te wa, ngā mihi.
Kia ora.
You've been listening to the Oncology Journal Club podcast, proudly produced by the Oncology Network. Don't forget to listen to the extended OJC Meets interview with Professor Chris Booth, where he and Chris Jackson dive into the world of common sense oncology. For regular news and podcast updates, we invite healthcare professionals to join us at oncologynetwork.com.au. Your free registration includes a free subscription to our weekly publication, The Oncology Newsletter, and it's a fantastic way to support the OJC. And don't forget to share your thoughts with our hosts on their socials. This is Rachel Babin, and this is the Oncology Journal Club podcast.